Over the past decade, homicide rates have largely declined, but prosecutors say it's still hard to get convictions in murder cases, in part because witnesses are reluctant to come forward. This is especially true in urban areas. In a working-class neighborhood of East Baltimore, heads pop out of windows and doorways as four men emerge from an unmarked beige van.
Why don't you come around front, leave Frank in the back?
They wear bulletproof vests and navy bomber jackets with the word police across the back. Two run around to the back alley. The other two step to the front door of a brick row house.
They come to your door.
These officers are part of Baltimore's homicide unit, a team created 2.5 years ago to seek out no-show witnesses. The people they're looking for have ignored court subpoenas. In some cases, the witnesses have skipped town. Others might have been killed. Their disappearance leaves criminal proceedings in limbo, so the state's decided it's worth the effort and expense to track them down.
I don't know where he's at at all.
Does he call you?
He don't call. If he called, I would let them know, because they've really been harassing me.
Right.
They really have been harassing me for like the last 6 months since he got shot.
That's the mother of a man police believe witnessed the murder of a local drug dealer last August.
Do we know if he's still alive? Are we hoping he's still alive?
I'm hoping he's still alive.
But there's no contact.
But he have not gotten, so he must know not to get in contact. You know what I'm saying? He must know. He haven't gotten in touch with me. And I can't make him call me. You know what I'm saying? If I knew where he was at, I would say, call him.
The woman says she last saw her son in the hospital. Shortly after the killing he supposedly witnessed, her son was shot about a dozen times. One official calls this the Baltimore Triangle. Today's witness is tomorrow's victim and possibly next week's perpetrator. Lieutenant Brian Matalunas says that's what makes it so difficult to track down these witnesses.
The people that we look for, they don't have jobs, they don't have credit, they don't have cell phones that are in their name, they don't have houses, they don't have cars. So, and a lot of the people that, you got to understand, in Baltimore, we have a lot of drug-related homicides. So a drug dealer's out on the corner at 2 o'clock in the morning, there's not going to be a businessman standing on the corner to be a witness.
Here's my name, the unit I'm with, the cell phone number. It's 24 hours. Okay, thank you very much, man.
As the police leave, they tell the woman that if her son doesn't get in touch soon, they'll issue a warrant for his arrest. It's called a body attachment. He could then be held without bond until the trial. A few miles away, we have an appointment with an attorney who's frustrated. In this city, officials say 25% of non-fatal shooting cases are dismissed, either because witnesses don't show up, or when they do, they change their story. In a green-carpeted, high-ceilinged courtroom in downtown Baltimore, Assistant State's Attorney Wes Adams walks to the judge's bench. Adams prosecutes murders, but he understands how scary it can be for the witnesses he calls in.
If you are a witness, you're sitting right here in the witness box. That always puts the witness almost within reaching distance of a defendant.
And often, a defendant has allies in the room, especially in drug or gang cases.
For example, in a case I prosecuted earlier in 2004, which resulted in a hung jury, I had approximately 12 or 14 young men in blue jeans and white t-shirts sitting in the back two rows of the courtrooms watching each and every witness testify. And there was one particular witness who was only about 17 years old who shook the whole time. Her legs were shaking. Her body was physically shaking. She could only look straight ahead and into the microphone. She didn't look up, didn't look around. She would clench her teeth at any time that she wasn't speaking. Her teeth were clenched. And she was on the stand for about 20, maybe 25 minutes. And when she finished, her face had swollen up like a grapefruit.
The layout of courtrooms is dictated by a centuries-old English tradition enshrined in the Sixth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. It's the right to confront one's accuser. Over the years, there have been numerous exceptions granted. They're called hearsay exceptions. For example, if child abuse is involved, a social worker can testify about what a minor told him or her without the child taking the stand. There's something called a dying declaration. If a witness utters an accusation on his deathbed, courts have found that to be so compelling and believable that the statement can be entered into trial without the accuser being present. Now, Maryland Governor Robert Ehrlich wants to create another exception. He wants the state to be able to use prior statements made by a witness to a crime, even if that witness is not in the courtroom. Patricia Jessamy is the state's attorney in Baltimore. Her office is across a busy street from the courthouse.
We're talking about instances where the actions of a defendant have made the witness unavailable because the witness has been killed or the witness has been threatened and intimidated and is in hiding and afraid to come to court.
Jessamy says Maryland wants to change a harsh reality, that right now, if you scare off the witness, you can kill the case. Governor Ehrlich would also toughen the penalty for tampering with witnesses from a 5-year misdemeanor to a felony that would carry a 20-year sentence. The governor's proposals are similar to what already exists in federal law. There, the legal reasoning is that if a defendant does indeed threaten a witness, he forfeits his right to confront that witness. But deciding how and when to apply this principle is controversial, and the governor's proposals have met opposition.
There's a reason why there's a confrontation clause in the Constitution.
Tim Mitchell heads Maryland's Criminal Defense Attorneys Association.
I think the Founding Fathers did not want a situation where anyone could come in, make an accusation, and never be challenged on it. There are witnesses that would give testimony that's not truthful and candid.
There's another objection to Maryland's proposal to overcome witness intimidation. Critics ask, how would you define intimidation? Is it actions or words or merely a look? And how could you prove that? William Murphy is a Baltimore defense attorney and a board member with the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers.
When witnesses get threatened, typically the prosecution has no evidence linking the threat to the defendant. He has a belief, a suspicion, but it's the unusual case where there's any evidence.
Murphy also points out there already are a number of ways to protect witnesses by hiding their identity. True, says State's Attorney Jessamy, but that's not the point here.
What this law goes to is not for those people who are afraid to come to court. It's for those individuals who are threatening and intimidating. That's what this law is directed towards, to take these people off the streets to be able to convict them.
Maryland's governor first proposed this law last year, and opposition killed the bill in committee. But now, Jessamy says she has a more persuasive argument. A few months ago, police discovered this homemade DVD circulating on Baltimore streets. It's called Stop Expletive Snitching. In it, young men jab their fingers at the camera and warn people not to talk to the cops.
We got a lot of rats up here we want to expose. You know what I mean? It ain't too many of them because we deal with them, you know what I'm saying? We don't really know who the real rats is, but we got a couple of them that we do know. But they ain't around here no more, you feel what I'm saying?
Jessamy says the tape proves her case better than any legal argument. She's been handing it out to lawmakers to promote the governor's legislation. Back in East Baltimore, detectives seek another witness. It's their second visit to this house.
Is he here today?
Not that I know of. No.
Two women say they have no idea where he is, but after a few minutes of questions, a young man in baggy jeans emerges from upstairs.
LT, we're good.
The police escort the man to the waiting van. They'll take him to headquarters, where he'll be questioned by the detective in the case. Even without the proposed legislation on witness intimidation, the work of this unit is starting to pay off. Officials say since they began aggressively seeking out witnesses, only half as many of their homicide cases have fallen apart. There's a footnote to this story. As we left Baltimore, we stopped by the city's Oliver neighborhood to see Reverend Iris Tucker. She has a special interest in making sure witnesses are not afraid to come forward. We met her on a cold, gray day. Tucker is pastor of the Knox Presbyterian Church. It sits just across the street from a blackened, boarded-up building that is still called the Dawson House. 2 years ago, a family of seven was killed in an arson attack on their home in the middle of the night. The Dawsons had been working with police to rid their street of drug dealers. Last week, the state agreed to help turn the Dawsons' home into a children's center.
You know, they did a lot of things in their backyard for children, and I think that they'll be pleased with it.
The Dawson tragedy drew national attention, and in part it led to the current legislation on witness intimidation. Reverend Tucker would like to say things have changed here these past 2 years, but she can't.
A man got shot and killed right past that light.
It happened last month as neighbors were gathering for a community meeting.
And two of my members, one of my teenage members, witnessed it. But her mother said, absolutely not. You're not going to say anything. Because the mother didn't feel like she could protect the child. And the child really didn't know what to do. And I didn't find out until after it was all over.
The girl came to Reverend Tucker for advice, but she says she just couldn't push her to speak out. Tucker is glad lawmakers are thinking about this issue, but skeptical that any legislation can make people here feel safe. For now, Tucker dreams of making the Dawson home an oasis for the neighborhood's children. Above the renovated house, she wants to build a rooftop terrace.
And we ought to be able to go up there and have sessions where we look at how far we can see and then talk about what it is that we do see. Because sometimes when you're on the ground, you're so low until you only see the negative. When you go up higher, you're going to see the positive.
A blustery wind starts spitting rain, and Reverend Tucker heads back into her office. Across the street, in a row house that faces the burnt-out Dawson home, a car has pulled up. Girlfriends gather around as a young mother carries a newborn up the steps and in the door. Our story was produced by Tracy Wall and recorded by Bill McQuay. To see pictures, go to our website, npr.org.